I grew up, you know, feeling slightly different. I had very low self-esteem. You know, I struggled with a lot of things. And I think that once I discovered substances, I felt whole. You know, I felt like I was in charge. I felt like I suddenly gained some magical powers that enabled me to engage and, you know, have a good time. I think when people talk about that, you know, I've heard it many times, that warm, fuzzy feeling of alcohol, that happened for me with substances.
I'm Paul Scholefort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. Today, I have an exciting guest, Johnny Graff, who's the co-founder of Lions Campus in Marylebone, which is a teen rehabilitation centre. The reason I got Johnny in is because he uses a different way to bring people from their addictions and their behaviours back into the community using psychiatrists, doctors, mentors, and coaches. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Hey, Johnny, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Johnny, the co-founder of Lions Campus London, Marylebone, which is a teen rehab.
Yeah, we are a teen supported living, and we run day programs.
How did that? I'm going to say quickly, congratulations, because you're 6 years sober today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Which is amazing.
I know, quite a coincidence that we're doing this on the same day.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's perfect. How did Lions Campus come around?
Well, most of my career has been in mental health care. I started out with setting up an adult addiction service in South Africa that became quite successful. And we primarily catered to the UK market for people seeking help and cheaper options for treatment. We started off as an addictions clinic, and in the first 3 years, we started getting a lot of female clients with eating disorders who would check in with an addiction issue, but it turned out that the primary issue was actually food and an eating disorder. So we set up an eating disorder clinic next door. And then I came to London 10 years ago to set up an aftercare service for those same clients.
A lot of people talk about alcohol and drugs, but not many people mention eating disorders. How do you, when you come into recovery from that, if you go into a rehab, you can't detox from that. So what's the process for someone with an eating disorder when they first come in?
For at Lions Campus, for us, it's a lot simpler because we're not an acute unit. So if you've got a BMI of, say, lower than 17 or 18, you'd be in a primary clinic and in a, you know, acute care where you'd be, you know, being fed, food was being monitored, calories counted, meal plan, etc. For us, the beauty about our business is that we start treating the whole person once they've completed that process. So we don't get involved in the medical side of things. So we don't do refeeding, we don't do detoxification, we don't do prescribing. What we do is we get given a treatment plan by a psychiatrist, and we support that treatment plan. But the sort of ethos at Lions Campus is all about getting you back and thriving in the world. So our focus is more on balanced living, engaging with the world, preparing young people for education, preparing them for the next school or you know where they're planning on spending the next phase of their lives. We even teach young people things like how to write a CV, how to budget. How to get around London, how to take public transport, how to shop for clothes, self-care. You know, I personally find the part of treatment that we do the most exciting part, because we're not up against the disease as much as a primary care would be.
Yeah, and it's interesting because on your website you use mentors and coaches.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that before from any rehab. Did you come up with that idea?
So you know, we have a team with which is really separated between, we've got two groups of people. One is, you know, highly qualified practitioners and professionals, and the other half are other young people with lived experience. And we find that combination, it provides a perfect mix, because, you know, a lot of the people that are on site every day are people with lived experience. So young people can relate to them because our team have been there. I've been there. You know, our counselors have been there. Our peer support workers have been there.
That's what I found when I went to rehab first, was I couldn't understand why my therapist was a recovering addict. And then she told me all of the therapists were recovering addicts. I thought it was really strange. Now I realize that actually someone who's gone through that whole process can spot things and help people like no one else can. What's your experience with that?
Absolutely. And you know, one has to ask the question, you know, why would anyone really want to specialize in addiction unless they had some sort of experience with it? I mean, you do find other people in the professional community who've often had a loved one with an addiction or alcohol issue or eating disorder, which has drawn them into it. And I think that, amongst professionals, you find more often than not, I certainly find it more often than not, that that people have had their own experience. What's quite interesting about what we do is that we don't label it. We don't focus too much on the substances. Our program, and this is why we don't use the word rehab in our program, because our focus is more on mental health. And young people come to us, they might have substance misuse issues, but very hard to tell if they're, genetically predispositioned to be an addict, or it's just a behavior, you know, as a result of some adverse life experience. Yeah. In our experience, young people that come to us have often experienced things that haven't been their choice. We find these days, you know, a lot recently of young people that have come to us because they've been bullied, you know, and there's been major trauma from being bullied, and bullied at school, online bullying. And, we're the ones that, you know, they would come to us. I had someone yesterday that came to see us, and she was like, "Well, you know, I want to figure out what's wrong with me." I said, "What do you mean? What you want to figure out what's wrong with you?" She said, "Well, I want to figure out why people, you know, choose to pick on me." You know, which is quite sad, actually. Yeah. You know, and I think what we don't realize is that you know, in the education system, and in most of Western Europe and America, it's not cut out for everyone. You know, there are a lot of people that fall out of that remit and suffer as a consequence. And I think what we do is we pick up a lot of the pieces of when it doesn't work out.
How old are your clients or fellows, and how long do they stay for when they come into the...
So our clients range in age from 16 to 21. They stay with us for a minimum of 3 months to our maximum length of stay is a year.
And that's an interesting one with bullying, isn't it? Because a lot of people say that they've had adverse things that lead on to addiction to make themselves feel comfortable or kind of belong. How do you address that bullying specifically? How do you build up that self-esteem in Lions Campus?
I often say to people that come see us, I think the most underrated and powerful part of what we offer is besides the team and the program and the lovely home environment we offer them, is a community. I think a lot of young people come to us, they've been incredibly lonely and isolated, and we give them identification with other young people, connection. They feel a part of. They don't feel they don't feel different. You know, they have the daily support from staff members that have experienced what they have, but they also have a peer group. And we also encourage them to tap into the incredible recovery community in London, which has become younger and younger. You know, the fellowships have become younger, and they now have the opportunity to go to those meetings and meet other young people and develop a new community of people that are living sober lives.
And how do they... Once they leave, it must be
it's such a great safe space then that you've created. I know when I left rehab, yeah, I felt pretty scared to leave because I was really looked after. How do you address that?
It's a good question because it is a difficult process. A lot of young people become very attached to living at Lions Campus and staying at Lions Campus. But what we usually do is we plan for discharge really early, and we also plan next steps. And we're also very fortunate because we're so small, we're able to create very personalized programs. And often prior to clients leaving us, months before they leave us, they might start doing a step-down program, which means they come in for 1 or 2 days a week. Once they've completed that stage, they come in once a week to see their case manager. We've even got a client at the moment who's working for us, who spent a year with us, one of our first clients. And, you know, they've just started as a recovery assistant. They're starting to be psychotherapist, and you know, we're incredibly proud of that.
So going back to you, John, in your recovery, when did you first discover alcohol or a drug?
Yeah, so I would say in recovery terms, I was probably quite a late starter because I started drinking at around the age of 18. Quickly followed by drugs, you know. I was never a successful drinker, you know. So
what does that mean for our listeners?
Well, a successful drinker, I mean, I think a lot of people, when I hear their story, they stayed in active alcoholism for quite a substantial period and they functioned to a degree. My experience with alcohol has always been I drank and then I just passed out and became really messy. So my alcohol addiction was very tightly linked to cocaine addiction, because when I discovered cocaine, I was suddenly able to drink. You know, I thought it was the best thing I ever discovered, because suddenly I was able to drink, you know, and manage my drinking. So I thought, you know, but for me also the wheels came off pretty quickly, you know, so.
But when you found the drink, was it a normal kind of, like the boys were going out for something to drink, and did it have an immediate effect? Because some people say in recovery that when they took their first drink, it was like they felt whole all of a sudden, and they felt great, and they felt strong, better looking, taller, whatever they say. Did that affect you in that way?
No, that happened to me with cocaine. You know, I certainly felt that, in hindsight, what I think is quite interesting, if you're, you know, I grew up, you know, feeling slightly different. I had very low self-esteem. I struggled with a lot of things. And I think that once I discovered substances, I felt whole. You know, I felt like I was in charge. I felt like I'd suddenly gained some magical powers that enabled me to engage and you know, have a good time. So I think when people talk about that, you know, I've heard it many times, that warm, fuzzy feeling of alcohol, that happened for me with substances.
Yeah, I think that was the same with me, actually. I always say that I weaned myself on alcohol because I saw the effects of it on people around me, some relatives.
Yeah.
And it always started off nice and merry, but there was always either violence or hostility or rage or something. And it just put me off. How would you describe addiction to people that are unfamiliar with it? Because a lot of people say, oh, they thought an addict, or they think an addict or an alcoholic is someone on a park bench, or they're associated with needles like usually in the movies. How would you describe it to someone?
The way I view it is I want to change the way I feel, you know, and how do I want to change the way I feel? I want to change the way I feel by consuming a substance, consuming a drink, buying something, you know, taking part in some sort of activity that's going to take me out of myself. And I think that the easiest way to really describe the affliction is to say, once I start, I can't stop. You know, so once I put that first drink in me, once I first take that first line, once I, you know, take that first pill, I can't stop, you know, and I'm going to repeat that pattern. I think that, as I'm sure you're aware, you know, the dread of waking up after a bender and the feeling of sort of despair just leads to repeat, right? You know, we have a few days of pulling ourselves together. The interesting thing with me is I didn't function successfully. you know, so I,
whilst using,
or yeah, whilst between. Using, yeah. I was not able, you know, I've met a lot of, most people I've met in recovery managed to hold down jobs, managed to hold down a relationship. I mean, as dysfunctional as they were, they managed it. I never managed any of that, you know.
What do you think the difference is? Because for me, I said that I never used every day and I didn't drink every day, because once I did, I'd just go around the clock until I couldn't anymore. And I know some friends, I've seen them. There was a guy I was talking to the other day who's coming back into recovery. And he goes to work and he goes to Liverpool Street so he can go in. So I think it's, I forget what shop he said, to get little miniatures. And he'll have like 10 miniatures through to lunchtime. Then he'll go out for a drink and he'll do the same in the afternoon. So he can manage his using, but I could never do that.
No. I mean, that sort of case sounds like somebody that is almost self-administrating, you know, enough liquor in order to stop withdrawals, you know. And look, everyone has a different response to substances, right? We all respond very differently, you know. Quite interesting, you know, when you come across people that come in very late into recovery. You know, they manage to bring up their families, and you know they manage to get to certain points in their lives, but the wheels come off much later. Mm. You know, your mid 50s, early 60s is when they decide to quit. You know, I spent years. You know, my addiction went from you know, I went through all the various substances, and my rock bottom actually was in prescription medication. You know, and for a very long time, I spent years isolating in a flat in London. You know, I just didn't leave the flat. I didn't really feel a need to take part in the world. You know, I was taking a lot of opiates, watching TV, isolating. Didn't really have a care in the world.
It's a huge addiction, the opiate thing. I remember being in Los Angeles with an agent friend of mine, and he'd been to the dentist, and we were sitting having dinner, and he started to sort of drop slowly to the side and come back to conversation and drop slowly to the side. And I just looked at him and I thought, he looks so happy. So I said, what have you taken? He said, oh, I've had a Vicodin for my tooth. I went, do you, can I have one? He went, yeah, sure. So we ended up both having this Vicodin. And I'm laughing now, but it's sad really, yeah. Because if you see two people on that drug, it's horrendous. Mm. And at the time I found it amusing. This was in the height of my using, but I loved the feeling, because for me it was like a warm blanket. Mm. It took away all of that nerves and anxiety, mm. which I suffered for a long, long time. How do you deal with that now? So I still have anxiety, nothing like I used to. And I have a program that I work of meditation and stuff like that. What do you do for anxiety?
I do a lot of sport. I find that sport, walking, is one of the best practical tools I've ever been taught. Is that someone was telling me that it's that movement of the hips has a direct message, gives a direct message to the brain to soothe you, relax you. I often walk back from work in the evenings. I often walk to work or cycle to work. I have ways in which I self-soothe, because I have a very obsessive, addictive nature, and I tend to get consumed with things. My kids also give me a huge distraction, you know, a beautiful distraction, because I'm forced to be present, forced to be, you know, in the moment with them, and not, you know, not preoccupied with something else. So key. You know, the root of everything, right, is meetings and 12-step recovery.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, I was feeling so wound up on Monday about a couple of things. And I you know, I went to Hine Street and then I went to Pond Street. And my, you know, as I go into these meetings, my shoulders drop, I absorb what everyone's saying to me, I connect, everything's fine again.
Yeah.
I can't explain that to you. You know, how do we explain that?
It's hard to explain for someone because if you're not in recovery and you don't know about a 12-step program, which was drawn up in late 30s and has worked on millions and millions of people, and it's a very spiritual program. It's a very practical program.
Absolutely. Practical.
Yeah. And it kind of, it's catered for everybody, no matter how old, how young, where you're from, what religion, if you have a religion or not. And it can cater for everybody, can't it? It's pretty, absolutely, pretty spectacular.
I mean, I used to feel quite protective and private about being part of the 12-step program and being in the 12-step program. But then I realized that I think it's so important for people that to know about it and know how it works and not be intimidated. You know, I think it's really important not to be intimidated, that it should be so common. It should be just, you know, for us to share about it.
It's funny. It's more common in America, and there's been clips on movies and advertising and different things. And I thought it was in Fight Club. Remember the scene? I thought it was just like people sitting in the circle, just hugging each other and stuff. I thought, that's definitely not for me. And didn't realize, you know, the profound love and connection that you have with people, and that's not actually the program. And I was fiercely anonymous for a long time. I'm nearly 20 years now. I really believed in anonymity, and then my story was published in the paper, so that was gone.
You know, I believe very fiercely that anonymity is key. I would never mention anyone that I know from the rooms or any, you know, disclose anything that was part of anyone's journey. But I feel that I am free to speak about my own recovery and you know, how I did it. And I think that the more people that know about it and the more people that feel less intimidated about it, the better for everyone. You know, it's the single best, one of the single best exports from the States, right? Ever invented, you know.
That and Mustangs, but yeah.
We all have bad days and sometimes bad weeks and maybe even bad years. But the good news is we don't have to figure out life all alone. I'm comedian Chris Duffy, host of TED's How to Be a Better Human podcast. And our show is about the little ways that you can improve your life, actual practical tips that you can put into place that will make your day-to-day better. Whether it is setting boundaries at work or rethinking how you clean your house, each episode has conversations with experts who share tips on how to navigate life's ups and downs. Find How to Be a Better Human wherever you're listening to this.
I was going to ask you, because Shannon, my producer, was talking about how it affects family members and other people around you. When you was doing rehab in South Africa, how was it for the families? Would the families bring in the people, and were they at a desperate state? How was that?
I mean, I think that's one of the most difficult challenges, you know, in recovery is, you know, there's a very strong view, which I agree with in principle, which is that it's a family illness and everybody needs to be treated. But the reality is, you know, my dad or my mom or my brother, they're not going to check in for a 90-day treatment program because I've got a problem. So what happens is they get a snippet and they get a snapshot and they get some tools. My theory on recovery is that it's your journey. You're the one that needs to change. The world's not going to change for you. You know, for you to have an expectation that your family members are suddenly going to have this miraculous awakening, you know, who's to say they need to? So I'm a firm believer in it is what it is, and the world is what it is, and the people around you are what they are, but it's for me to change. And I think as soon as you change, your perspective changes. And the key is acceptance. I accept everyone around me. I accept how the world is. You know, I don't challenge that. I drive myself crazy imagining that I could.
That's true. Do you think that it's genealogically passed down, addiction? Do you think it's... Gabor Mate says it's 51% of it's usually trauma. But it's definitely a genetic component. What do you think about that?
So, great psychiatrist that I know, he used to say that the genetics load the gun, and the environment pulls the trigger. And I'm a firm believer in that. You know, so I'm a firm believer in that in my family there's been addiction, and the addiction has played itself out in different ways: workaholism, success, you know, all sorts of things. But I think because we're all born unique. So I've got two brothers who went through exactly the same life experiences as me. We just handled it very differently. We all went to the same boarding school. They loved it. I thought it was awful. you know. So the effects that the sort of my boarding school had on me, you know, Gabo Mate would probably classify as trauma. Mm. But for my brothers, they weren't trauma. Now, so what does that tell you? It tells you is that we all respond differently to adverse life experiences. And some people are much better to cope with them than others. Genetically, I think I'm predispositioned, for sure. But I think that my responses to that predisposition have been maybe someone that's been traumatized as a result of just being physiologically who I am.
Yeah. How's your mindset before you come into recovery compared to now, like your thought process? So like you said, your experience of boarding school was horrendous. Mm. How do you, I know you said you had acceptance, but how's your mindset changed since you've been in recovery, 6 years?
I think it's quite incredible, actually. I think early recovery, there's still a lot of blame. There's still a lot of self-pity. You know, there's a lot of anger. And I think the scary thing about recovery is that it takes quite a long time, in my case, over a year, to actually land and make sense of everything. And the biggest aha moment for me was when I realized that, you know, I was at the center of a lot of my own problems. You know, it was quite liberating, actually, because I realized that my responses were not in proportion to what was going on around me.
Which is commonplace in people's stories in recovery, absolutely. Right? So how do you maintain a happy balance between work and recovery? Because a lot of people, when they come into recovery, get obsessed with work and can be workaholics for a while. How do you find that balance?
I had a great sponsor once who said to me, drew a picture on the wall, a sort of pyramid of priorities. And he said to me, you know, the number one is recovery, because without it, there's nothing else, right? I mean, there's no family, there's no business, there's nothing. So that's always on the top of my mind. When I wake up in the morning, top of my mind is recovery. Which meeting am I going to this week? Which meetings am I going to this week? What recovery work am I going to do? And you get these nuggets, right? And, you know, nuggets like Monday, having a difficult day. I know. What does everyone say? Reach out to a newcomer. Find someone with less time than you. Reach out to them. You're going to feel better. And without a doubt, you do, right? Got a resentment? Write it down, throw the piece of paper away. It sounds absurd. But we do it, and it works. So I think that is, you know, that's the key. I also gauge my responses to, you know, my level of irritation to people and things is a good indicator of how strong my recovery is on that day. Mm. You know, we know that, right? I mean, you know, when I start losing my shit in my head, I know that I'm not spiritually sound.
It's amazing you're so open about it. It's really nice to hear, because some people aren't so open about their recovery, or they try and have a perfect veneer where they don't lose their temper. They levitate
absolutely
above the
not.
Kitchen floor.
No. I think those are the dangerous people. You know, I think that if you put on a facade of perfection, it's not authentic, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think if you... You know, I don't expect someone to come and share a sort of pity party with me and bring out the violin, but I respect people being authentic and real. We all do, right? I mean,
it's
give me a taste of who you are, I'll give you a taste of who I am.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's key. But I do also think that we are examples, right? We do have to carry ourselves with a certain amount of dignity. I mean, I can't go into Starbucks and start losing my shit and throw the coffee cup on the wall and
that won't do.
No.
How's your relationships now with people? Because I really found it hard before coming to recovery. I thought I was shy, but actually I realized I was self-conscious. And it was an aha moment for me. I was like, oh, actually, it's because I'm self-conscious. When I walk into somewhere, I'm worried that the person's either better educated, or they have more money, or they're funnier, or whatever it is. Or if I'm on a date, am I wearing the right thing? Is my hair okay? What if I say the wrong thing? And for me, that all didn't all go. But when I realized that I was self-conscious, not shy, I felt that I had the power then to change that. So therefore, my relationships become more honest and more intimate, in the sense that I love the acronym into me, you see, for intimacy. And that's how I try and have friendships and relationships. How's yours changed?
I think that one of the major differences is in my recovery now, the sort of center core of my circle are all in recovery. You know, that's been a major change, because I find that I'm much more at ease with other people in recovery and much more relaxed. Obviously, I engage with people, you know, normal people, right? Yeah. But I find that my most intimate and closest friendships are people that are in the rooms with me. I think the gift of recovery, one of the gifts of recovery, right, is that in my relationship, for example, with my family, my wife, my children, there's so many nuggets of wisdom that we're given all the time that we apply to everything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
It's quite interesting you saying that, because I mean, being on about 100 campaigns and magazine covers and things, that you still felt those sort of insecurities.
More so through. I think it was funny because when I was quite a strong character as a teenager, if you looked on the outside, I'd probably be confident, stroke a bit cocky, and I think I was I found school quite difficult, dyslexic, and there was no program or facilities for that at the time. So it was easier for me to be either looking out the windows at cars, which I love, or starting to be the clown with some of the other guys. I remember I had a really wonderful English teacher, and my mum was in hospital for a year and a half with tumours, and she was very unwell. And Mr. Bowles, my English teacher, was a very strange man. He used to wear brown Clark shoes, blue corduroy pants and a blue top every day, all the time. And he really had a hard time for some of the kids. And I heard through the grapevine that he had cancer. And I had a chat with him for the first time, looked him in the eye and had a conversation with him. From that day on, I sat at the front of the class and became really good at English and really listened to this man. I think that's part of the relationship thing and the connection for me.
I think that what you've touched on is one of the cornerstones of what we do at Lions Campus, which is kindness. You know, I think that story with the teacher is an example, you know, of how, you know, one act of kindness and one interaction with someone and understanding where they are and your attitude changing and shifting. I had this very similar experience at school, actually. You know, I had someone put their arm around me, my history teacher, a lovely woman, and she said, you know, we really need to get you back on track. I thought, wow, you know, you're taking the time to take an interest in me, and I started excelling from that day.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we also try and do that at Lions Campus. You know, we take a very deep interest in everyone, because we know that you know, you've just also you sort of articulated quite beautifully how we don't all fit into mainstream schooling education. You know, and to be fair, I don't think there necessarily are the resources to cope with the, you know, diversity of education needs. But I think what, you know, it's so key that where people are understanding about, you know, what sort of, you know, if you look at the wide array of professionals in London, you know, you look at you know what possible thing could maths or science or, you know, any particular curriculum offer, you know, improve their lives if they're going into the creative field or whatever. You know, I mean, it's a whole other discussion, right? Education, yeah. But it's so important.
But I think if going back to what we were saying, if you know, you, for me, being a model and very successful in it for a long time, because I didn't do well in school, I think because I wasn't comfortable and I wasn't heard about certain things, like some teachers were amazing, but generally it wasn't my cup of tea and I couldn't understand what we were doing and why. And I was a very, very good athlete, so they'd punish me by saying, you know, you can't be in the race team unless you're doing this. And I didn't like that kind of thing. And that's the opposite, really, in recovery, isn't it? When I started to model, it was interesting because I was confident at first, because probably because I had no idea what I was doing. And I thought it was just a new place and everyone was lovely and it was creative and kind of like recovery. Everyone had a common goal and a purpose and was putting into the pot for that to create something. But after a while, that confidence started to wear off through criticism. Mm. I remember doing my first show in Milan for Catherine Hamlet, and this guy was looking down, and he looked up and he went, "Oh, he's short, isn't he?" And looked down again, and I heard him. I was like, "Oh my God," like he's talking about me. Correct. And I think after a long time, I put on a good front about it, but actually inside, the narrative inside my head was horrendous for hoping that I was going to be good enough or cool enough or fit the job. And it is surprising when you see people on paper do really well that you wouldn't know that that's what goes on underneath.
Mm. Never. Where did you spend your early recovery? I know you went to treatment in London.
Yeah.
But where was your early recovery? Was it in the UK?
Yeah, so I'd flown back from Los Angeles and landed in London for about 6 months. I thought changing environment would have worked, and it didn't, obviously. So I checked into rehab here, and I spent the first year of my recovery, funny enough, where we're recording. I joined an acting school about 5 months in just to try and get confidence over the road.
Oh, wow.
My first scene to do was, we had to do a scene. It was Meisner technique. And my coach was like, "Okay, bring in stuff tomorrow, do a scene, whatever means something to you." So I was going to be an alcoholic, right? So I bought in a bag full of like cans and papers and messed up stage and stuff. And he called action, and I was laying on the floor in the corner, and I sort of got up and woke up and did this whole dramatic thing, and then went to go towards the kettle, and he just put his hand up and said, "What exactly are you doing?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm an alcoholic. I've been on a big binge, and I'm just getting up." He goes, "That's not what alcoholics do." And I said to him, "Yes, it is. How would you know?" And he said, "Well, I'm 13 years sober."
Oh, wow.
And I burst out crying. I said, "Can I have a conversation with you?" He went, "Yeah, let's have a cup of tea." And it was amazing because his name's Tom.
Yeah.
And Tom took me under his wing, basically. So in my first year, it was just around here, sort of East London, North London, that I went to one meeting every day, 7 days a week. I went to acting school, which is really interesting, actually, especially for Meisner technique, because some of the processes you do is you look people in the eye, you hold hands, and you repeat sentences. So you'd say, for example, "Oh, you've got a blue jumper on." And I'd say, "Yeah, I have a blue jumper on." And the idea is that you all go through an array of emotions, like rage or love or sadness or feeling, you know, intimidated. But you can sit there in your body and learn to go through these emotions, which before I'd have run away from, or I would have drunk on them and not felt anything. So I think actually Meisner technique is actually a really interesting process that could be incorporated in a rehab. So for the first year, that's literally what I did. I didn't watch TV. I listened to CDs at the time about recovery because I really wanted to know what is recovery. Mm. How did I get myself into a state where I was taken into rehab by a friend? Like, what happened to this jolly young kid that said he would never drink because he saw what happened to, you know, people around him? So the first year for me was really reading through the 12-step program backwards and forwards. I had two dictionaries, American one, a British one. I wanted to know what the words meant because it was written in the late 30s. So some of the words like tight, you know, getting drunk at the wrong time. And so I just studied. And the whole point really was that I just wanted to get better. I didn't want to have that internal narrative. I didn't want to have the fears. I just wanted to walk into somewhere and say, "Hi, how are you doing?" Instead of having this pounding thought process of, "Oh my God."
Quite interesting for you, I think, also, is that you had that natural discipline of sports when you were younger. You're quite a naturally disciplined person.
Yeah.
It stands you in quite good stead in early recovery because it is just repeat, right? You know, repeating the same thing.
Yeah, it is. It's finding your, if you're coming in, it's really about finding the similarities, as we know, because you can walk into a room of people and point out the differences. You know, we're from a different place, from a different demographic, whatever it may be. We've done different jobs. But it's about finding, really, can you identify with the processes, the emotions and the thought processes and stuff like that, right?
Absolutely.
Johnny, I always ask this question. What, if someone's listening to this podcast, what advice would you give them if they do have a drink and drug problem or they think they have a drink and drug problem? What's the first steps that someone should take?
I would get to a meeting, get a number, and repeat. You know, I have to say this, you know, it took me 20 years to, you know, it doesn't have to take you 20 years, but it took me 20 years of trial and error to get 6 quality years, you know, that I wouldn't swap for anything. And I say to people, keep coming back, you know, because we don't know, you don't know when you're ready. You know, I met a newcomer yesterday, you know, I don't know when he's ready, but when he's ready, I've got to be there, right? What do you think?
No, I totally agree. I think that fortunately we have the internet. There's loads of services.
Absolutely.
There. There's Zoom. Drug helplines here. There's lots of phone numbers that you can go to, Frank or whatever. There's lots of rehabs, you know. And really ask for help, but to the right person. I wouldn't walk into a pub and ask the friend that you drink with for help, obviously, but ask for help off someone.
I think one of the best things that ever happened to me was I was 6 months in, I still didn't feel a part of. And there was a service commitment, a greeter going. And the woman next to me put up my hand to take the service commitment. And from that day, I met everyone because I had to greet everyone coming to the meeting. And suddenly I felt a real part of rather than an observer.
Yeah, that's probably right. Thank you, Johnny. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Paul, for having me. A real pleasure to be here.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. A big thank you to my guest, Johnny, today. If you want to find out more about what he does and more about Johnny, please check the show notes. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scholford.